Hello, I am joined today by Dr. Megan Cruz. She is a board-certified medical oncologist specializing in breast cancer, and she's the director of breast medical oncology and co-leader of the breast cancer research program at Cleveland Clinic. She received her Doctor of Medicine from Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine and completed her residency in internal medicine at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. She then completed her hematology and oncology fellowship at the Cleveland Clinic, where she served as chief fellow, and she joined medical staff there in 2017. Dr. Cruz is nationally recognized for her contributions to breast cancer research and education. Her primary area of clinical and translational investigation is the optimization of care for patients with lobular breast cancer. She also developed the comprehensive lobular breast cancer program at the Cleveland Clinic. She's amazing and so excited to have her here to talk about a really big topic. Thank you, Dr. Cruz, for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yes. So I know, and we were joking just before we started that Megan here gets the biggest, most controversial topic in breast cancer that I think we've seen in quite some time. Yeah. And that's the SERENA-6 clinical trial. We're going to be going through all of the SERENA-6 trial and the controversy that has come with it. So I'm excited to get your take on some of this.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk it through because I think that our opinions on this are evolving.
Yes.
Every day I feel a little bit differently about it.
So. Yes, I totally agree. So we're going to kind of get through the story and the emotional journey that all of us have been on with this trial.
It's a roller coaster.
Yes, it has been. So just to kind of start out, you know, really the key foundational concept to all of this is these ESR1 mutations. This is really the thing that we're seeing take over breast cancer right now, mm-hmm. with a lot of the new drug approvals. And we talked about it on the podcast before with some of our other guests, because again, so many of our drugs now are being approved for patients with ESR1 mutations. Mm-hmm. Will you give us your take on what's an ESR1 mutation? Why do they matter?
Yeah. So when I think about ESR1, I think about the main way that cancer cells find a way to survive despite our standard of care endocrine therapy, mm-hmm. right? And so this is really a change that evolves under the pressure of treatment, specifically in the metastatic setting. What's a little bit curious about these ESR1 mutations is they don't tend to show up with adjuvant endocrine therapy. They really tend to show themselves after first-line metastatic mm-hmm. therapy. Mm-hmm. And what ends up happening is you can think about the estrogen receptor really changing its shape, right? So mm-hmm. I go back to these diagrams in my head that are in some of the articles about this, where you look at the estrogen receptor as one shape when it's wild type, and then it kind of closes down on itself a little bit, mm-hmm. makes itself constitutively active or always on when this ESR1 mutation is there. And really what that means functionally is that you can block estrogen all you want, right? Mm-hmm. And this receptor will act like it's there no matter what when the ESR1 mutation is present. Mm-hmm. And so we can use our conventional therapies like aromatase inhibitor, even some of our early generation SERMs and SERDs, tamoxifen, fulvestrant, mm-hmm. and they may not work as well when this ESR1 mm-hmm. is present because the target is different. And so that's really the excitement about some of the newer agents we have is that they seem to work regardless of that estrogen receptor sort of changing its conformation, changing its look.
Mm-hmm. I love every time I get to talk with someone on this podcast about ESR1 mutation, I love hearing how people explain it. I just take away something unique from everyone. So yeah, I love some of the terms that you use there and this whole idea of changing the shape of the estrogen receptor. Mm-hmm. Also, too, you kind of alluded to this. I want to ask you a little bit more. The fact that this develops over time, right, after exposure. So because of that, the way we test for it matters. Mm-hmm. Will you give us, what is our current standard for how we're testing for ESR1 mutations?
Yeah. So this has evolved over time, right?
Yes.
Because I think in breast cancer, we were so used to having all of our biomarkers up front. We didn't necessarily need to go back and look again. And of course, that's changed as we're thinking more about evolution and things like HER2, but also ESR1. And so because it develops as the cancer is trying to survive, and we expect it to show up later on in the disease course, mm-hmm. you have to check for it as time goes along. Mm-hmm. And so this is not one of those ones. There are many of our biomarkers that you can go back and look at archival tissue. You can look at your original metastatic sample. This is not one that would fall into that pathway. And the other thing that's interesting about it is we know that even though tissue biopsies and tissue NGS has been our standard for mm-hmm. so many things, We actually get much better results for ESR1 when you're doing blood-based testing.
Yes.
And I like to think about that as the blood giving you a more global picture of what's happening in the body, right? Mm-hmm. If we're sticking a needle in one metastatic site, we're getting a limited piece of information just about that site. But we know, even though we talk about breast cancer like it's all one big similar thing, that it's such a heterogeneous disease. Mm-hmm. And even individual metastatic sites are going to look very different from each other. Mm-hmm. And so when you're getting a blood-based sample, a liquid biopsy, you're capturing all of that diversity mm-hmm. of metastatic mm-hmm. sites, hopefully, if your cancer is shedding into the blood, which is another story.
Right.
You're getting all that at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I would say that our best practices for ESR1 mutation testing are on liquid mm-hmm. and after prior therapy. So this is something that certainly after progression on first-line therapy you're getting. And this is where Serena-6 kind of turns that on its head, right? Because we may be looking a little bit earlier.
Yes. And I think it's so important to stress the fact that this mutation is unique because it develops with time. It's not there at the beginning. Because I've definitely seen patients before where, you know, we've done this test and this mutation has popped up. And we're like, oh, you have this mutation. And they'd be like, well, you know, why didn't you find this sooner? You know, and because it wasn't there.
Right.
You know, it develops over time, which makes them so unique and leads us to the trial of Serena-6. But also, too, before we get more into the details of Serena-6, we talked about SERDs. You mentioned SERDs, you selective estrogen receptor degraders, which is, you know, really the new class of hormone blockers we're seeing kind of take over the breast oncology space right now, which we're so excited about. What about SERDs makes them unique and more effective mm-hmm. in breast cancer right now, especially when it comes to ESR1 mutations?
Yeah, so I think the fundamental idea here is that that degrading part of the SERD term, mm-hmm. right, is really important because we're not just blocking, we're not just temporarily like hiding a receptor. Theoretically, the way these drugs should work, we're physically getting rid of it, right? We're degrading it. It's not there any longer. And so I think of it as more of a comprehensive lack of estrogen sensitivity and signaling mm-hmm, in these cells mm-hmm. when you're physically getting rid of the target. Mm-hmm. And it also seems to track that regardless of how that estrogen receptor looks, these drugs are working. So they're mm-hmm. getting around that specific mechanism. But then I think there's also enthusiasm about, could this strategy work in different settings, even outside of these ESR1 mutations, because you are just physically taking the estrogen receptor away.
Yes.
And it gets to a lot of what our patients wonder about, which is, you know, how can such little estrogen drive my cancer growth? And it may be because you don't even always need the estrogen around to make the cancer grow, right? This is a situation in which we can get rid of all the estrogen we want and cancer cells will still find a way to survive.
Yes, absolutely. And too, like kind of going back to your initial explanation where, you know, with these SERDs, what we've seen is, you know, even if the receptor is the normal one or the mutated one, if you're destroying it with a SERD, it shouldn't matter.
And so
we should have more efficacy. I want to get into the Serena-6 clinical trial design. Let's start with the design, because even the design itself can be hard to comprehend it when you're just like looking at it in a picture. So the Serena-6 clinical trial, large phase 3 trial, what makes this trial so unique is that in this study, we were looking at changing a patient's treatment for their breast cancer before we see the breast cancer grow on a scan or like disease progression mm-hmm. anatomically or radiographically. But instead, we're switching their therapy once we detected an ESR1 mutation mm-hmm. develop. And so the way that the trial worked is patients, you know, they enter this screening window. And in order to enroll, you had to have metastatic hormone receptor positive breast cancer. And you had to have been on your first line endocrine therapy, CDK4/6 inhibitor for at least 6 months. And so patients entered screening where they started getting tested for ESR1 mutations every 2 to 3 months. Mm-hmm. And then once an ESR1 mutation was detected, then patients would get randomized 1-to-1 to either continue their current AI and CDK4/6 inhibitor or switch to a new SERD, camizestrant, mm-hmm. plus their CDK4/6 inhibitor. And so what was very interesting about, you know, kind of looking at the initial patient population is 50% of patients had an ESR1 mutation on their first mm-hmm. test when they entered screening. And the other thing, too, that's worth noting in relation to that is that the median time to randomization of this patient population was 23 months, so almost 2 years. Mm-hmm. So these are really what we call endocrine sensitive mm-hmm. patients. Is it surprising to you that so many patients had ESR1 mutations like right off the bat detected?
Yeah, not at all. I think when you put it into those contexts, because with this trial, the devil is certainly in the details,
yes,
right? Like all
100%.
Of these little factors matter.
Yeah.
And I think fundamentally, the design makes sense, right?
Yes.
Are there pieces that maybe retrospectively we would go back and do a little differently? Probably. And I think mm-hmm. that this point about so many patients being positive at the time of first test is one of those things that makes us all stop and pause, because that two-year-ish number, 23 mm-hmm. months, mm-hmm. sounds very familiar. This is progression-free survival mm-hmm. for many patients in the first-line hormone-positive breast mm-hmm. cancer mm-hmm. setting. So are we surprised that patients have a mechanism of resistance detected then? Not mm-hmm. really. Mm-hmm. I mean, 50% mm-hmm. median progression-free survival.
Yeah.
And if you look at the timing of when the results are positive for patients, it's all over the place, right?
Yes.
Like
yes.
with that 23-month median, I mean, it's as low as the first couple months. And I
yes.
think the highest goes up to like 99 months or
yes.
something.
Yes.
And so, you know, it really goes to show you that this will evolve for different patients at different periods of time. Mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. clearly what that 50% number positive at the first test is telling us is that these mutations have been around for a bit of time
yes.
for most of these patients.
Yes.
So that's tricky
uh-huh.
when you think about the activity of the switch strategy, because these patients, probably some of them were already on ineffective therapy at the time
yes.
that they went into this randomization
yes.
to the oral SERD or continuation of their standard therapy.
Yes.
So that makes it, in some ways, I think it may even underestimate what we see
yeah.
in terms of results of the camizestrant.
Yeah.
And it probably means that patients would do well with this approach if we started testing a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
But I think the caveat to that is testing off the bat, right at that 6-month mark, mm-hmm. probably doesn't make a whole lot of sense either.
Yes.
Right? Because they're
yes.
going to be very few patients who I think are having the mutation develop that early.
Mm-hmm.
So there's
mm-hmm.
a sweet spot here. We just don't entirely
yes.
know what it is.
Yes, exactly. And that's been very confusing for people when talking about this trial, which I completely understand, because they're like, well, you're saying that they had to be on their CDK4/6 inhibitor for 6 months.
Yeah.
But then wait, you're saying everybody had been on it for 2 years? What? How does that work? And so that's really kind of getting to the way trials work. You know, when we're at centers and we open a trial, the trial becomes open to enrollment. And so we immediately look at our patient population to say, oh, you qualify for this mm-hmm. trial. Here, you can enter screening. And so the way that it just happened to play out is that a lot of the patients, once this trial opened and they went into screening, they just happened to be patients that had been on their treatment
wherever
far
they were
longer than 6
yeah.
months. Yes.
Right.
Yeah. So that's where that comes from. And I totally understand that. That definitely impacts the patient population when these are very endocrine sensitive patients who were doing very well. And so we talked a little bit about the basic setup of the trial. Again, so patients are getting randomized to camizestrant, which is our SERD, that's dosed orally daily, 75 milligrams daily, continued their CDK4/6 inhibitor, and they got a placebo for their AI. So mm-hmm. patients did not know which drug they were getting. So this is why it's called a double-blinded trial. Mm-hmm. Versus, again, patients who continued their AI, continued their CDK4/6 inhibitor, and got a camizestrant placebo. And then the primary endpoint of this trial, which is what we've seen results for, is progression-free survival, which is very typical that we're used
right.
for all of our metastatic trials. What we found is that patients who made the switch to camizestrant, they had a significant improvement in their median PFS. Their median PFS was 16 months compared to 9 months in that standard AI CDK4/6 inhibitor arm. When you saw this data result, what was your initial reaction mm-hmm. to that?
I think not surprised. You
yeah.
know, it has not sat well with me, and I think a lot of people for a while, that we knew that these mutations are developing over time, and it means that patients are inherently on treatment that is probably not working for them. Now, how quickly does it take to develop the mutation? have the treatment become ineffective, develop disease that may be symptomatic or you can see it on a scan.
Yes.
That's the part that we don't really understand,
yes, exactly.
Right? And that's going to look different for literally every patient we treat. Mm-hmm. You know, some are going to have more rapid disease progression. They're going to be symptomatic fast. But I think a lot of our patients in this space, many times their first progression is subtle symptoms, scan changes. So I don't think we were entirely surprised. And there were other studies leading up to this point,
yes,
that kind of proved this phenomenon, mm-hmm, right? And I think mm-hmm. PADA-1 was the big one. Mm-hmm. Of course, using fulvestrant, which mm-hmm. is not our optimal SERD anymore in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But and also tough for patients, mm-hmm, right? We know that that drug, while still very much a part of our everyday management, it's a nasty intramuscular injection. So the day that we can replace that with an oral option, I think we're all mm-hmm. waiting for mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. But this to me is further proof of concept that the biomarker indicates true resistance development, impending disease mm-hmm. progression. And so it just made sense that if you act on that you would see better outcomes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think what is tricky and what has played out is that it's really hard to compare in a standard way progression-free survival on one treatment that you've continued the whole time mm-hmm. versus this switch strategy.
Yes.
It's just a change in philosophy for us as
yes.
a community. And the idea of acting on something before radiographic progression is so contrary to
yes.
how oncology has been for decades.
Exactly, exactly.
Right? So in many ways, it's just making our brain do some acrobatics that
yes.
we're just not used to.
Yes, exactly. And I want to pick your brain a little bit more and kind of talk about the controversy of this result. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, so, well, one of the more obvious things that came up with the design is that, okay, testing patients with this liquid biopsy every 2 to 3 months, mm-hmm. Which could play out to happen for years,
yeah.
You know, if we implement that in real life, that has a cost,
mm-hmm.
You know, so what's the financial toxicity going to be for our patients, for the healthcare system? And then I think the big question with the PFS, we all want to know, you know, could we not just switch the patients in the control arm when they progressed? Could we switch them to camizestrant, which did not happen in the trial, they
mm-hmm.
didn't have crossover, or switch them to another approved SERD? And then match up that same PFS benefit.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that question. Well, why not just wait? It's probably going to look the same. And then, of course, overall survival.
Yeah.
The bigger question is, making the switch actually helping our patients live longer, or are we changing therapy just sooner
mm-hmm.
without actually like changing the big picture?
Mm-hmm.
When you look at the trial, what were kind of some of the big concerns you had? Because there's mm-hmm. so many different arguments. I'm only scratching the surface. What are the big ones in your mind?
Yeah, I think that the point that you made about this is not a decision we're making in a vacuum, right? We know that oral SERDs are already here
mm-hmm.
for ESR1 mutant breast cancer patients in the second line and beyond setting,
mm-hmm.
right? And so it's very logical to say, okay, what if you didn't do it proactively and you just did it at the time of standard old progression?
Yes.
And so it's very possible you can explain it away and say outcomes could be completely neutral.
Mm-hmm.
Outcomes could be better because we're acting on that resistance earlier and maybe mm-hmm. patients will get a longer duration of time on the oral SERD. That's actually what we're hoping for, mm-hmm. right? Or you could take the completely contrary view and say, if you only get the sort of same duration out of that oral SERD, whether you start it early versus a little later,
yeah.
are you actually creating a detriment for patients and making them burn through options faster?
Yes.
And it's really crazy because
yes.
based on the way this all played out, how it was designed, the lack of crossover, where patients who were in the standard therapy arm, they didn't change anything about their treatment based on the detection of the mutation, most of them did not get an oral SERD later on,
yes.
whether it was camizestrant yes. or another one. And so it confounds this whole, you really can't figure out if starting earlier or later makes a difference.
Yeah.
Now, that being said, there's still this fundamental problem of, if you know that resistance is happening, do we just let it happen? And I think that's a bigger picture question of what does that really mean in the lives of our patients? How do they feel? What is the burden of this testing, both financially to their peace of mind and quality of life. And we'll come back to quality of life because it was also very interesting and important in this study.
Yes.
And part of the reason I love that you highlighted that this was placebo controlled, because at least that part, I think we absolutely got it right in terms of the study design. But yeah, there's a lot of like logistical factors about this. And some of it is philosophical, which makes it even harder because it may vary patient to patient of what level of uncertainty are you okay with? How much do you want to know? How much does extra testing add to your life or subtract it from your life in a quality of life way? And I think that's the part we don't entirely understand as we've not really implemented this strategy. I will say that liquid biopsies tend to be very feasible in the clinic.
Agree.
You know, I think the even the coverage, the financial aspect of this, the financial aspect to the system may be enormous if we adopt this approach. But the financial impact on the patients, I hope, is not a significant barrier because we just haven't seen that. I think a lot of our industry testing partners have been very helpful in getting patients the information they need without the financial burden. It's not universal, but it's better than it was.
Yeah.
So, and then I think the impact on our practices is another really big point. The idea of this testing being every 2 to 3 months, I mean, again, that's an interval that feels right for some patients, right? I think in my practice, I'm getting scans every 3 months for a lot of my patients. For those with prolonged disease control, we might be spacing that out a little bit. So perhaps this is more testing than they would otherwise have, and that can have a quality of life impact. But I think for the most part, if you think about scanning every 3 months, getting the blood test every 3 months, it actually kind of lines up pretty logically.
Yes.
It's an additional step for us, but if it's really meaningfully impacting the lives of patients, we can do it.
Yes.
We've done harder.
Yes, absolutely. So well said. So many great points. And the quality of life piece. Okay, let's dive into that. First, though, can't really dive into that without touching on side effect profile of camizestrant. Can you touch on side effects that we see with Cami? Any big red flags?
Yeah, so it's an interesting medication, right? We are learning that these oral SERDs are a little bit different in their side effect profiles. And camizestrant has a couple toxicities that I think are notable, manageable, but notable. One of them is slowing of the heart rate, bradycardia, which thankfully for most patients, pretty much all patients in the trial, this was like an asymptomatic phenomenon, right? Their heart rates went down. We could see it. It's part of the what makes this whole placebo-controlled blinding thing a little bit challenging, because if your heart rate went down, you kind of already knew what you were on.
Yes.
But, you know, there's that end of things. I think it is potentially a distressing thing for our patients, though, in current society, where a lot of our patients are very in tune with monitoring of health parameters at home. And it can be distressing if your Apple Watch is detecting that your heart rate's going low, particularly when you're asleep. But as physicians, I think we know that actually lower heart rates for many of us are completely fine.
Yes.
And we will feel fine and we will go about our everyday lives and not really realize it's happening.
Yes. And that's what trials showed too for
patients. Yeah, absolutely. People were not stopping the drug because of that side effect. So I find that notable but reassuring. The other piece that I think is newer, and we've got to kind of wrap our heads around this, is the concept of photopsia. So photopsia, for those that may not have heard that term before, may not be familiar, it's this sort of sensation of flashing lights, particularly in the peripheral vision when you're going in light contrast environments, right? So really bright rooms to really dark rooms or vice versa. A lot of our patients would tell us, you know, if you're watching television in the evening, or if you've been working on a computer monitor all day, you're driving potentially at night, right? These are the situations in which we worry about it. Now, thankfully, it seems reversible when you stop the drug, number one. No actual eye damage here.
Yes.
It is something that patients tend to adjust to over time. Like it's there, but it's not really affecting them once they know what it is. And again, not really a reason people stop treatment. So functional consequences don't seem to be the biggest concern. Distressing, I think, a little bit because it's an odd toxicity. It's new. I think as we've learned about more about it and that it's not permanent and that's not causing eye damage, that has been very reassuring. But it does stand out compared to the other drugs in this class.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are definitely two of the unique things we're seeing seen with this, sir, that all caught our attention, you know, when we first started using it and seeing it in trials. And then just looking at, you know, the most common adverse events that were reported on the study, really the first few are all cytopenias, low blood counts related to the CDK4/6 inhibitor. So all reassuring. In terms of menopausal side effects with camizestrant, or maybe even SERDs in general, what have we been seeing?
Yeah, seems favorable. This is another kind of weird trial versus real life story.
Yes.
Where I think our clinical experience as we've started to use these drugs has actually been very favorable.
Yes, agree.
And patients have mentioned that they often feel better if they know they're getting an oral SERD. And even patients on this particular trial, I think many of them would talk about that they're particularly musculoskeletal side effects, but some vasomotor effects too. We're better.
Yeah.
And it's a complicated situation because we know that by far and away musculoskeletal toxicities, joint aches and pains, stiffness, muscle aches with aromatase inhibitors are a big deal. And we see them for a lot of patients. But even the switching of one aromatase inhibitor to another aromatase inhibitor, taking a break, helps with these toxicities sometimes. So you also wonder if a patient was switching therapy, you know, are they better on the SERD? Are they just better with a switch? What is behind that? And that's going to be really tough to piece out in everyday life because I don't know that our tools are sensitive enough to figure out what is making a difference. But I'm not sure that it matters.
I agree.
If patients feel better, they feel better. So, you know, I think this is another one of these things where we've been poking holes in this theory about why patients feel better on it. Is it psychologic? Is it, you know, the mechanism of the SERD? At the end of the day, they feel better.
I know. Yes. And all of the data that we saw from quality of life data, and they've presented quite a bit of quality of life data and patient reported outcomes data, consistently showed that the patients who made the switch to camizestrant had much better quality of life. And in all different areas they presented, they had less emotional distress. They had better physical functioning. They had less musculoskeletal pain. I mean, the list goes on, which again, so reassuring. They also, when the study was first presented, showed graphs for this time to deterioration. Which was so interesting, and we saw that the patients in the camizestrant arm had much shorter, longer time to deterioration. They felt better longer. And, you know, we were all asking the questions that you were just explaining so well about, okay, is it, are they feeling better because the drug has less side effects and they're switching to camizestrant and a lot of their, you know, arthralgias and other side effects are going away, so they're feeling better? Or is there also some component to us, you know, treating maybe some micro metastatic disease that we can't see? That I think we've all seen patients in the clinic where they just start feeling not well. And we're like, oh, something feels off, but their scans are okay. And then sure enough, later on, you know, they progress. And it's like, are we, by tackling the CSR1 mutation, are we actually doing something to eradicate micrometastatic disease that's making them feel better? And they've shown some data to show that switching to camizestrant lowers the ESR1 mutations in the blood. Any other thoughts about that? I've been really intrigued by seeing all this data.
I am too. I think it's a really powerful message because, and it's something that patients ask about, that like, why do I have to wait until I develop a complication or until you see it on my scans? Like, isn't it better to just not get there?
Right.
And it's a very valid point when you take a step back because those progressions are not going to look the same for everyone, right? And I hate the idea of our patients having to have more pain. And, you know, are we attributing some of this musculoskeletal pain to AI when it's really evolving bone metastases? Or, you know, are there subtle GI symptoms that we can't pick up very well that's really peritoneal carcinomatosis? We don't really know these things. And yes, for most of our patients, their progression into the second line is subtle, as we were talking about earlier. But sometimes it's not. And when it's not, it can be very, very life-altering. And so I also think from a quality of life standpoint, there is nothing worse for quality of life than progressing cancer, right? Physically, emotionally, psychologically. So if we're preventing some of that, and I think we're not great at picking those things up. I mean, if you think about the tools at our disposal, scans are pretty rudimentary, right? Like we're not using a whole lot of like more minimal disease detection activity tests, mm-hmm. partially because we just don't know that that influences overall outcomes.
Right.
So there's a purpose to it. It's not like we're willfully ignoring that technology.
Yes, yes.
But, you know, it might actually influence quality of life. And mm-hmm. so I think a lot has been made about this data simply in terms of drug effect on quality of life and side effect profile, but it could be more.
It
could certainly yes. be better control of the cancer. And actually, that would be the best way that this story is evolving is mm-hmm. because I think that then predicts hopefully better long-term overall outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've really hit on kind of all the big questions and arguments that have been going back and forth with the field, within our field, which people have very strong opinions about. So ultimately, this is not an FDA-approved treatment regimen yet. It is ultimately up to the regulatory authorities, the Food and Drug Administration, to decide and approve this regimen. But as the story has been unfolding, we saw at the end of April that the ODAC, which is the Oncologic Drugs Advisory Committee, met to review this trial. Will you explain for us what is ODAC or these committees and how does this whole process work? Because I get a lot of press mm-hmm. when ODAC met and they voted. Give us a little more context about that.
Yeah, it's actually fascinating. It's the yes. first time in my medical career that I've actually watched an ODAC presentation. It's freely available. You
yes,
can watch it on
absolutely.
The internet.
You can read the report.
Yeah,
it's very long. But
yeah, it's very yes. long. It's very long. But watching it play out was very, very interesting in real time. And I think it's amazing because this conversation we're having, it was basically that conversation on a bigger scale.
Yes.
Right. So this committee includes individuals who should have the backgrounds to help evaluate if new oncologic approaches in terms of drugs make sense in the overall cancer treatment paradigm. And also evaluating that the safety is where we want it to be to bring this to routine care of our patients. And so, you know, there are oncologists who sit on that mm-hmm. panel, breast cancer experts in this situation, as well as medical oncologists who are not in the breast cancer field to give sort of that additional overall oncologic lens,
yes.
medical appropriate
yes.
lens. There are biostatisticians who can help mm-hmm. to comment on the trial design. And which was really interesting about that is that the statistics of the trial really hold up well, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that mm-hmm. that is reassuring in many ways. Mm-hmm. There's also patient advocates on this committee thinking about how is this actually impacting the lives of our patients and maybe ways that we are blinded to as physicians, not living mm-hmm. that experience ourselves. Mm-hmm. And as part of the whole process, the FDA gives sort of their interpretation of the data, their findings, concerns. The study team is also able to give their expertise in how it was designed, why it was designed, what conclusions they draw from the data. And then there's also this really powerful piece of these proceedings where you have doctors, oncologists talking about their experience with patients, why they think that this may or may not be meaningful, and patients also lending their experience. Mm-hmm. So the whole process is really, really interesting to watch it play out. And as you watch for this specific situation, you can feel the tensions back and forth,
yeah.
right? You can feel the areas in which we really see promise of this approach and the areas where we're a little uncertain and we're a little reluctant. And I think the votes on that were also consistent with that approach. So I think, you know, the final vote ended up being not in favor that this trial and camizestrant was able to meaningfully say we're impacting the cancer control for our patients. And it centered largely around the idea that we need more data, mm-hmm. right? Overall survival data was a big, important part of the conversation. But I think this trial is also very, very interesting because it was leading to questions about overall drug development, future cancer trial designs. And so it felt like there was maybe even a little bit more at stake
yeah.
other than just this one drug and just this one setting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because there, I personally, based on some of the data that you highlighted, where you're seeing the mutational burden of ESR1 mutations go down very rapidly mm-hmm. with initiation of the oral SERD, wherein the patients who continue on AI in the same CDK, we see their ESR1 mutation load just go up during the time on treatment. So although this is a biomarker that we haven't entirely proven changes overall outcomes, they think the science is there. And so there were lots of questions about, can we use this biomarker as a surrogate? Is it really well validated enough? My answer to that seems yes. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, the committee ended up voting not in favor. And typically, ODAC rulings or votes, they're not really rulings, but impressions do factor in largely to final FDA approvals.
Yes.
So the story got more complicated this past week.
Just last week, yes.
Where, you know, we were expecting sort of the final FDA review of this data to come.
Yes.
And it's actually been pushed back.
Yes.
And so I think more time is needed, reflecting that we're all still figuring it out. And it's hard to know where it's going to go. And then, of course, the other thing that happened is it was viewed very favorably by the European regulators. And got approval from the EMA in Europe. So it's an interesting situation of where we go from here, because there are not that many examples where the decisions are opposed to each other. When where patients may be getting different standard of care. That happens a lot. I would say the standard of care in the U.S. is different than other places in the world, but it's not usually the reverse.
Yes. And historically, like you were just saying, historically, the FDA follow suit with whatever the committee recommends. Mm-hmm. And it's really the FDA leans on these committees for their expertise mm-hmm. in what to do. Mm-hmm. And also worth noting, I love how you explained how these committees work. Also worth noting, like, these are not government officials on this committee.
Right. Yeah.
These are doctors that we work with and know at our academic mm-hmm. centers who, I mean, give their time for the greater good to mm-hmm. to give their expertise on these situations. So, yes, we're all still left hanging, waiting to see what the FDA is going to do. And this could really impact care for our patients. Like you said, I think the reason this has just rocked the oncology community is because, you know, the whole way we are trained as oncologists is to maximize time on each line of therapy. Mm-hmm. And so this challenges that whole paradigm.
It does.
And we, it just makes us nervous. And we want to be sure that we're doing the right thing for our patients and giving them quality of life and meaningful quantity of life as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's, you know, the interesting thing about the biomarker question, the other thing that came up, of course, is the control arm and that lack of crossover. And as I've sat with that, because it would be wonderful to have all patients exposed to an oral SERD or even camizestrin itself without the other options in the second line if they were on the control arm. That would answer the question much more clearly, right? But as you listen to the ODAC committee, it's a very interesting point that when patients progress in this space, it is not at all clear what the standard of care is. I think we all wrestle with that every day.
Yes.
That's like our next most controversial topic.
Yes, absolutely.
Is what do you do when you have multiple options in one line? And a lot of it has to do with the fact of, like, what's the biology of the disease at that time? What have patients had for prior treatment? And it is hard to find a one-size-fits-all approach in this space for a control arm or as a subsequent therapy.
Yes.
And so even though it's a valid critique of the study, when you really take a step back as a practicing clinician, you see why we got here, right? Because mandating another endocrine therapy for patients who were clearly developing more significant endocrine resistance, that doesn't seem like a great idea. And that may have been hard to get patients to enroll in the trial.
Yes.
Because it could have actually been more detrimental to them.
Yeah.
So I think that there are the things that make sense on paper and would make answering the question a little clearer. But then there's also the aspect of, like, meeting your patient where they are, getting them the care that they need, using that clinical judgment, just being a physician.
Yeah.
And that's hard in trial design.
Yeah, absolutely. The last thing, too, I want to get your thoughts on before we wrap up. You were talking about, with ODAC and the breast oncology community, overall survival.
Yeah.
We want to know about overall survival. We don't have that. And it's hard to know if, you know, it takes years to get overall survival results with metastatic hormone receptor positive breast cancer because our patients do so well, thankfully. It's a great problem to have. And two, as the field evolves so rapidly, it's getting harder and harder to detect an overall survival benefit in our studies. So we're now seeing results get presented for PFS2.
Yes.
We saw a glimpse of that when the study was first presented. We're going to get some updates at ASCO here for PFS2. Mm-hmm. What is that? And what are your thoughts on PFS2? Is that meaningful?
Yeah, PFS2 has become, I think, like over the last few years, it's part of our everyday language
yes.
when it absolutely wasn't before.
It was not a thing before. Yes. Yeah.
So, I mean, fundamentally, if you're thinking about this, you're taking patients from the time that they are randomized and start their trial-defined therapy, right? And then following them through all the way through that first progression, time on to the whatever drug comes next to that next progression. So that whole cumulative time is their PFS2. Encompassing the duration of control on the first therapy and the second therapy. And the hope would be that if this medication that they're having at the time of that initial treatment switch is really influencing their overall outcomes, that we should see that trend carry through the PFS2. The outcomes should still be longer. What's tricky about that, particularly in this trial, is that the PFS2 is almost PFS2 for one side yes. of the trial and PFS3 for the other yes. side of the trial. Because some of these patients in the camizestrant switch arm, effectively by the time you're reading out that PFS2, they've had three regimens, right? They've had AI-CDK,
yes.
camizestrant plus the same CDK, and then something else. Mm-hmm. Whereas the patients in the control arm had AI-CDK followed by something else.
Yeah.
And so it's not entirely a fair comparison. And then the other thing that factors in here is we know that there are now drugs that we're using in later line settings, and this wasn't always the case, mm-hmm. that truly impact overall survival, right? Antibody drug conjugates, we're living that revolution right now. So many of these patients would have received drugs like that as their next line therapy. So when you're impacting overall survival with those other therapies, it's really hard to see the survival impact of whatever you did first. And also, these different subsequent therapies, there's going to be a whole bunch of them. Everybody's going to receive a different number.
Yeah.
It's really hard to control for,
yes.
especially with global studies where access to drugs is not
absolutely.
The same. So it makes analysis near impossible.
Yes. Yep.
And what worries me for PFS2 is the same thing that worries me for overall survival, is that it's going to be so hard to draw a definitive conclusion of which part of the management led to whatever we're seeing. Mm-hmm. And that's why I don't know if we can hinge our hat on overall survival, honestly. I mean, it's going to take time to come. And are we doing a disservice to patients by not having them have this option now as we're waiting for that? If we knew that that was going to definitively solve the question as an endpoint, there'd be a lot of validity. But knowing that it may not solve this yeah. quandary no matter what makes me even more uneasy about waiting.
Yeah.
So it really is a very complicated, I think it's a problem that's only going to continue to worsen as we have more and more options coming to the space.
Yep.
Hopefully better options.
Yes.
So
yes.
it's just going to be tough to show a benefit.
Yeah, I completely agree. I worry too, are we, delaying getting an option that could be really meaningful for some patients? Are we delaying getting that mm-hmm. to them by just waiting years for OS that, again, who knows how interpretable it's
yeah.
going to be?
Yeah.
I think kind of the way that I'm framing it is, you know, if this gets approved, and again, we don't know yet, this is not approved yet, we will wait and see. But, it I think it's going to be a conversation with each patient.
Absolutely.
Some patients might love this approach, and others not so much. And I think it's going to be different for every patient. So
yeah, I think about that now as patients are, because our patients are really savvy, and many of them have already started to ask about this.
Absolutely.
There's been a lot of media attention to it. And, you know, I think I always take a step back and say, will this testing add to your quality of life mm-hmm. in some way?
Yeah.
Does it give you better power over your disease? Does it give you more knowledge? Does it give you access to a treatment that you might feel better on this? Or is it going to detract from it? And the detract from it is real, right? You might feel completely fine, and knowing is only going to introduce uncertainty in your life that may not be beneficial. Mm-hmm. And maybe that looks a little bit different for each patient based on their prior therapy, their volume mm-hmm. of disease. Again, this is why all these conversations are so individualized and they take time. Mm-hmm. Even if this were to come to our clinic tomorrow as a reasonable approach and an FDA-approved approach, I don't think it's applicable to everybody. Mm-hmm. And that has to be okay. It's much harder when that's the case.
Yes.
Because it puts the onus on us to figure out who it's right for and who it's not right for.
Yep.
But it's also, I think, what keeps the field interesting for us and meaningful for our patients.
I agree. Megan, you helped dive into such a big topic so well. I appreciate you so much for being here, talking through such a controversial topic with me. Thank you again for being here.
No, thank you. Every time I talk it through, I feel like it becomes a little bit clearer. And and the perspectives on this are really helpful. I think this is a time that we lean on each other to do it as a team.
Yes.
And that's the best part about oncology. So thanks for having me.
Thank you.